From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up...
I would tell you that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. He was a man that gave up his country to fight for his state, which in 150 years ago was more important than country. It was always loyalty to state first back in those days.
We'll talk with two historians about White House Chief of Staff John Kelly's view of the Civil War. Also today, a different take on democracy. We'll look at how a group of Boston thinkers championed a broader American ideal in the years just before the Civil War. And a trip into the bowels of the Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology.
A bunch of Nile monitors are found throughout the continent.
This is a species that has a very long whip-like tail. It can get 5 feet, maybe 6 feet long.
Evolution. What a long, strange trip it's been. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
You know, there were actually some pretty solid moments in John Kelly's Fox News interview last night. The White House chief of staff talked about averting nuclear war with North Korea. Laura Ingraham even had some pushback to Kelly about President Trump's celebration of China's President Xi Jinping. And in talking about the enormous criticism he received after he criticized a Gold Star widow, Kelly even admitted to wondering if being in Washington was, quote, all worth it. But all of that fell by the wayside when, in response to a question about the removal of Civil War monuments, John Kelly said this.
The lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War. And men and women of good faith on both sides made their stand where their conscience had them make their stand.
With all due respect, Mr. Kelly, I disagree. Slavery led to the Civil War, which is also why some historians reacted to Kelly's comments with these words: strange, depressing, profound ignorance, the Jim Crow version of the causes of the Civil War. And it's all stranger still because just a few breaths earlier, Kelly had accused Americans who want Civil War monuments removed as having, quote, a lack of appreciation of history. So let's take some time here to set the historical record straight. And helping us to do that is Michael Vorenberg, history professor at Brown University. He's also author of Final Freedom, The Civil War, The Abolition of Slavery, and the 13th Amendment. Professor Vorenberg, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna. It's nice to be on the line with you.
It's good to have you. Also with us is Karen Cox, professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. She's author of Dixie's Daughters, The United Daughters of the Confederacy, and the Preservation of Confederate Culture. Professor Cox, welcome to you.
Thank you so much, Meghna.
Well, before we dive into the specifics of all the compromises that were attempted prior to 1860, I just wanted to get the first reactions from both of you as to, you know, what your initial thoughts were when you heard that John Kelly had said a failure to compromise is what led to the Civil War. I mean, Michael Vorenberg, what'd you think?
Well, this is an old theory, and it is one that we associate with a previous era. A long time ago, there was a theory that a generation failed to come to a compromise, and that's why there was Civil War, as if there could be a compromise around an issue like slavery. So this is often called the blundering generation theory, and that is that a different group could have made a compromise. But behind that assumption is, like I said, this assumption that slavery was something that could be compromised with.
Yeah.
But my first reaction was there were compromises. Over and over again, there were compromises. And the people who couldn't compromise were the pro-slavery people. They had gotten concession after concession. Lincoln's Stand was a compromise. That is, slavery will exist, continue to exist where it will. But that was not enough. And they, fire eaters, mm-hmm. as they were known, pushed for a system whereby slavery could exist just about everywhere. And that was way beyond anything like a compromise. So
right.
In some ways, General Kelly's right. There was a failure to compromise, but it was only on one side, and
okay.
That is the pro-slavery side.
Okay, so we'll get more into that in just a minute. But Karen Cox, I wanted to get your take here. I mean, were you surprised, or perhaps not, I don't know, to hear John Kelly say failure to compromise?
I think my reaction was, oh, God, here we go again. We're going to get set back. Americans are getting set back in terms of their understanding of the history of the Civil War. And so, you know, I'm sure most historians were shaking their head after hearing that. And my concern was that here's a person who's in the White House and has the respect of a lot of people, and he's basically espousing a false narrative of the war, and that's problematic.
Mm, or at least a narrative that has long been put to rest by historical scholarship. I mean, because my understanding was in the years. Reconstruction years, for example, and perhaps even into the early 20th century, the whole reconciliation narrative between North and South was fairly dominant. I mean, Michael Vorenberg, is that a fair assessment?
Yes, it was a reconciliation narrative. It was a heroic narrative, and standing in the center of that was Robert E. Lee, who received quite a bit of attention in these remarks by General Kelly. Karen can speak to this more than I, because she's written quite a bit about monuments and other memorials that come out of the reconciliation. But Lee's role in this is important, the symbol of Lee, as someone who nobly surrenders and sort of steps aside and becomes the honorable man, despite the fact that he was effectively the leader of the most famous army in a rebellion.
Well, let's just
a traitor.
Let's just hear. I didn't want to cut you off there because you were saying that Robert E. Lee was a traitor. But let's just hear what John Kelly said yesterday about his views of Robert E. Lee.
I would tell you that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. He was a man that gave up his country to fight for his state, which in 150 years ago was more important than country. It was always loyalty to state first back in those days.
So, Karen Cox, what interested me about that moment is that it seems as if John Kelly is working very hard not to say that Robert E. Lee fought to preserve the institution of slavery. But in the whole state versus country thinking that Mr. Kelly put forth there, isn't another way to look at it is that Robert E. Lee was saying, no, his country is the country that would fight to preserve slavery, and that was not the Union.
Well, he doesn't even mention slavery in the entire interview.
Yeah.
So he's the other, you know, flip side of that is that he acted personally in rebellion against his own country. By, you know, taking up arms, and he fought in. I mean, you can't get around the fact that he led an army and fought in a war that was essentially going to maintain slavery, and that's what's problematic, you know, with a lot of what he was saying about Lee.
Right. You know, I want to get back in a moment to the attempts at compromise that the United States went through in the decades before the Civil War. But just, you know, to put in no uncertain terms the centrality of the institution of slavery to, you know, the Civil War, I was looking at some of the documents of the Declaration of Secession from various states, and I just want to read a couple sentences from a couple of the states. You know, Mississippi said, "Our position is thoroughly identified with the institution of slavery, the greatest material interest of the world." Texas said that non-slaveholding states had held a, quote, unnatural feeling of hostility to these southern states and their beneficent and patriarchal system of African slavery. Georgia said the South, with great unanimity, declared her purpose to resist the principle of prohibition of slavery to the last extremity. South Carolina said it objected to the election of a man to the high office of President of the United States whose opinions and purposes are hostile to slavery. So I guess what I'm saying, Michael Vorenberg, is to me, I'm one of those many people who are stunned that there can be any other read of the Civil War. I mean, I don't know what more to say than that.
Well, there's the wishful thinking that somehow a compromise could have been achieved around slavery. And we'll probably get to this later, but such compromises had been achieved, most notably in 1850. It was a compromise of 1850 was unsatisfactory to many parties, but it did compromise around the slavery issue. It gave us, unfortunately, things like the Fugitive Slave Law. So I think there's also this idea of a kind of denial that somehow we can believe in compromise without actually having to face the realities of what that compromise necessarily would entail, which would be an untenable moral position.
Right.
And so I think that's constantly what's going on when we talk about states' rights, this sort of holding on to an abstraction without facing the reality behind it, which is pro-slavery.
Well, so in the founding of the nation, there is the three-fifths compromise written into the Constitution of the United States, right? I mean, dealing with the compromise that northern and southern colonies had to reach that said enslaved peoples would be counted for the purposes of the census as three-fifths of a human being. Then we move to what? 1820 in the Missouri Compromise when Missouri wanted to enter the Union as a slave-holding state, Karen?
Yes. And so, you know, there's a, I mean, this is one of a series of compromises.
Yeah.
I think the professor is probably better equipped to speak on that. But yes, there's been a series of compromises over and over, as he said, and that, you know, and then it's always been about still maintaining this institution of slavery.
So, Michael Vorenberg, I mean, I was just kind of jumping around there from the writing of the Constitution to the Missouri Compromise. There's the Kansas-Nebraska Act, 1854. I mean, there are many, many attempts here.
Yes, and then also, so even at, you read a number of the secession declarations. So even after the seven states of the Deep South have seceded, using these explicitly pro-slavery sentences, even after that, there are attempts to compromise. And Congress is trying to frame a compromise. They will fail. Actually, that's not entirely true. There is, for example, Congress puts out a constitutional amendment, proposed constitutional amendment, that would restrict, essentially ban the ability to interfere with slavery where it exists. And that passes Congress, gets the two-thirds majority needed, and is submitted to the states for ratification in March of 1861. And Lincoln, in his inaugural, mentions it and actually approves it. So, of course, it becomes irrelevant much later on. So there were constant compromises or efforts at compromise, although there was never really any chance that those would succeed after secession.
Yeah, and then I just want to reiterate a point that you were making about that the Civil War certainly was ultimately inevitable because of the fundamental moral corruption when you're asked to compromise on a morally indefensible thing like slavery. But
can I add to that?
Yeah.
It is because of, one could argue that it is because of compromise that the war came later than it might otherwise have come, right? Mm-hmm. So that it's because of compromises that you've mentioned and the compromise of 1850 that this, in a sense, you could argue is postponing the inevitable, and that, in fact, the story of compromise is the controlling story, is why the nation survived so long without a war.
Right. Well, I want to play another cut from John Kelly's interview last night, because remember, this entire moment in his interview was sparked by a question about what he thought about the removal of Civil War memorials. And here's actually how he started that answer.
I think we make a mistake, though, in as a society and certainly as individuals, when we take what is today accepted as right and wrong and go back 100, 200, 300 years or more, and say what those, you know, what Christopher Columbus did was wrong. 500 years later, it's inconceivable to me that you would take what we think now and apply it back then. I think it's just very, very dangerous, and it shows you what how much of a lack of appreciation of history and what history is.
Karen Cox, what's your response to that?
Oh boy. Well, I think the only person who's lacks an appreciation for history is in that clip is John Kelly, and it's not, you know, I mean, here's the thing, it's like he's saying, well, you can't take whatever, you know, we think today and apply it back. No one has even tried to do that. I think that it was wrong then as it is now, and no history is being erased here if a monument is removed. What's happening and what would be taking place is you're removing an artifact of the Jim Crow period. Mm-hmm. We're not erasing Civil War history. We're not, you know, and nothing is being erased. History will still be there. History will be in books. we're talking about an artifact or artifacts of the Jim Crow era.
Yeah.
So this is what we're discussing right now.
Right. And I mean, to me, what I thought is, wait a minute. I mean, part of the job of historical scholarship is to apply the hard-won lessons of history and turn them back on the events, you know, that got us here. Why shouldn't we be using the moral framework that we have today as a means by which to examine our own history? And then, you know, honestly, to then examine how we behave and how we organize ourselves in our societies today. I mean, John Kelly seems to be saying we shouldn't be doing that at all and just accept at face value what those people who, you know, live through those events, you know, say that they mean. And that seems to be a very strange take on the purpose of historical scholarship or just learning about history. Michael Vorenberg, your response to that?
No, I completely agree, Meghna. And that is what he's trying to say. Essentially, that there is a true history, and it's the history that he's talking about. And anything that would compete with that, he wants to relegate to political correctness. And, you know, that's what it becomes, is this rhetorical device to make it about somehow taking sort of lefty liberal values and creating a false narrative history. But that's not, of course, what's going on at all. What we have here is, as you just said, decades or a century of scholarship that allows us to take apart what is a false narrative. He is claiming this false narrative is, in fact, the truth. Also, there's another part, the clip you just played, which really needs to be thought about. He says this is what society is doing. The trigger for this is not what society did. This is what a church in Alexandria did.
Right.
A church on its own terms, in its own congregation, in a democratic fashion, made the decision to remove plaques that were put up in 1870. And so this is a Jim Crow story. They were put up as a Jim Crow move toward the period where Reconstruction is being pushed against. Furthermore, they're not being removed. They're being removed of their current location, and they will be relocated. So this is a church, an Episcopal church, that's doing this. It is a religious community. And it's also, and Kelly in the same interview talks about how he goes to Arlington to pray. And there's incredible hypocrisy here, because the community that's doing this is a religious community that's chosen a course that he just doesn't like.
Yeah. So I want to play one more piece of tape, because you mentioned the word prayer, and I don't know what to make of it. But Laura Ingraham asked John Kelly, what does he pray for?
I pray for world peace. I pray for our society that seems to be so broken right now and against itself. I pray for my family. I pray for my son and all the fallen. I pray for a lot.
Karen Cox, my last word goes to you, because I thought, you know what, Mr. Kelly, a lot of us pray for the exact same things, but it seems to be a long road to achieving those prayers for as long as the White House chief of staff dances around the issue of slavery in the Civil War.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't caught that before, earlier, we could pray for, a true narrative of history and not a false one, and not one that he particularly ascribes to. And for the people who are, you know, there's like double injustice there. You know, there's the injustice of slavery, and then there's the injustice of history as he's, you know, perceives it and is trying to defend.
Yeah.
And so that to me is what the sad part is. And that's why I think as historians, we must speak up and we must correct what's incorrect.
Yeah.
So that this doesn't continue.
Well,
we're on an uphill battle when someone in the White House is able to say that and communicate a message that that people believe in, and just kind of reinforces that.
Yeah. Well, Karen Cox is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Cox.
Sure. Thank you.
And Michael Vorenberg, professor of history at Brown University. Professor Vorenberg, thank you as well.
Thank you, Meghna. Thank you for having me on.
Before the break, as you were hearing, we were talking about White House Chief of Staff John Kelly and his view of the United States Civil War. Well, it turns out that at virtually the same time, I mean, I'm talking about around the Civil War, in 1857, in Boston, an entirely different conception of what the American idea is was taking shape. And the Atlantic senior editor Yoni Applebaum writes about it. He joins us now from Washington, D.C. to talk about it. And Yoni Applebaum, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's great to be with you again.
It's good to have you. And, you know, it was like kind of almost, it was actually entirely by accident that we had you today alongside this conversation about John Kelly and the Civil War, because it's such an interesting juxtaposition between what you write about Boston, 1857, and the view of the Civil War that Kelly was talking about. So can I just get your quick take on John Kelly's comments?
Sure. John Kelly's reflecting an understanding of this war that has come down to us from a period in which Americans wanted to forget why it was fought. It was a lot easier to reconcile the nation and to rebuild it without grappling with the hard issues that it had posed. And so Kelly is in some sense, a man of his generation, reflecting an earlier misconception of that war and not really dealing with the ideas and the stakes and the human lives that were bound up in that fight.
Yeah. So tell us then about this entirely different notion of America and the American idea that was taking shape, as you write, in 1857 in Boston that led to the founding of the Atlantic magazine.
Well, this may be tough to imagine today, but there was a moment when American democracy seemed vulnerable to demagogic extremes, when the democratic project around the world felt embattled and in retreat from an assault by authoritarianism, when people were not sure that a pluralistic, diverse, democratic society could endure. And in 1857, which was one such moment, a bunch of individuals who were leading literary lights of their own day had dinner at the Parker House Hotel right in Boston, and they set out to do something that was really brash. They set out to create a publication that would contain what they said would be the American idea, and that was doubly brash because first, bold to claim that a relative backwater like America could have an idea that the rest of the world ought to pay attention to, and second, to try to positively define a vision for the country at a moment when most people in America were still defining themselves, increasingly defining themselves by what they opposed.
Right. And so 1857, we have Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, James Elliot Cabot, Oliver Wendell Holmes. I mean, very well-known names here. And the thing that many were starting to define themselves as opposed to, of course, in part was slavery. But you write about how the fact that in the attempt to define this American idea, these leading thinkers had the revelation, or at least the inspiration, that they had to also define themselves as being for something.
Yeah, they really did. And they reached to the work of another Bostonian, the fiery abolitionist preacher Theodore Parker, who had given speeches outlining his conception of the American idea. Parker said that it should be a government of all the people, for all the people, by all the people, right? These are words that will get taken up by other better-known orators a decade later.
Well, but he also gave us the language of the moral arc of the universe, right?
Yeah, and he has this notion that America forms part of that, that it bends in that direction, or at least that it ought to, that America ought to stand for all people being created equal and possessing unalienable rights and having the opportunity to develop and enjoy those rights. And that was a fairly radical vision in the world of 1857. In Britain, which was nominally democratic, only one in seven adult white males could vote in 1857. In Massachusetts, pretty much every adult male had the right to vote, black and white, propertied or impoverished. And so Boston was already this very unusual place at the time that they're articulating this. But instead of sort of looking around them and seeing the failure of the democratic experiment, these guys decide to double down on it.
Right. But you also write, though, that, I mean, this isn't a pristine political moment in Boston by any means, though, because the city is also, or the state is also, in the grips of know-nothingism, right? And pushback against the waves of incoming immigrants.
Absolutely. And they hold the governor's mansion in the State House at the time that the Atlantic is launched. I should say something that some of these guys will later embrace themselves, this degree of nativism, although not in 1857. Then they are still fighting for a more capacious understanding of human rights. And they commit themselves to this project. And the project gets taken up by Lincoln and by the Republican Party. drawing out of the same mix of ideas, sometimes explicitly citing the Atlantic. And there's a second American founding that happens during the Civil War, a redefinition of the nation around these particular values. Not consensus, not agreement. Nobody agrees on which of these things to prioritize at what moments or how best to achieve them. But they're having an argument in which there's a common set of goals or ideals and then really fierce fights over how to get
there. You summarize that common set of goals through the words of Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, "I'm as good as you be." But the reason why I really wanted to talk to you, Yoni, is because later on, deeper in your piece that you wrote in The Atlantic, you write this. You write that the universalism of the left, and we're talking about today, and the cultural nationalism of the right are battering America's sense of common national purpose. Under attack on both flanks and weakened by its failure to deliver exceptional results, the nation's shared identity is crumbling. Now, how long, though, did it take to build up that sense of shared identity after 1857?
Well, it's been an ongoing project, and you know, it would be wrong to pretend that this has ever been universally embraced or ever left uncontested. This is a nation with profound injustice in its past. At the same time, there's always been this sense that the nation can be called to account, that we can look at each other and say, This thing that we have done, it does not measure up to our ideals. This is the yardstick by which we'll measure America, and we'll see where it's fallen short. If we lose that, if we lose the ability to say, these are the American ideas, this is what this nation stands for, and if we lose the ability to call ourselves on it when we fall short of those ideals, if we retreat into sort of an arid cultural nationalism where we're just proud of ourselves for being ourselves, melt away into a sort of gentle universalism in which there's nothing distinctive or special about America, then we lose the ability to call ourselves to account as well.
Do you give equal weight, though, to the universalism of the left, as you say, and that cultural nationalism of the right in terms of the forces that are weakening our shared identity?
No, they're neither equal in terms of the force that they apply nor the risk that they pose. There's no question that the strong racial or cultural nationalism that Donald Trump and others have promoted is the greater threat. I'd add as well that neither are they separate phenomena. They feed off each other to an extent. If people feel as if a pride in America is fading, they're more likely to turn to that kind of a cultural or racial nationalism. And similarly, if people feel repelled by the nationalisms that they hear people promote, if they don't hear people promoting a nationalism of ideas and ideals, they're more likely to turn away toward universalism. Yeah. So this is a mutually reinforcing cycle.
We've just got a minute to go here, Yoni, and I'm so glad to be able to talk to you today because, you know, I have to remind myself, 1857, the nation is on the doorstep of destruction, right, of the Civil War, of breaking apart, and yet these thinkers came together to say we can champion a positive ideal. Is there's a sense of deep division today? I mean, what's the lesson? We've just got 30 seconds here, but what's the lesson that we can draw from what happened at the Parker House?
You know, they didn't say we need to compromise. What they said was we need to define a vision that we can persuade our fellow Americans to embrace. And that actually is what happens. And they managed to build a nation which moves incrementally and sometimes unevenly toward justice over the ensuing century and a half. That's not a bad standard by which to measure ourselves today.
Yeah. Well, Yoni Applebaum wrote about the American idea and the founding of the Atlantic magazine in Boston in 1857. We have a link to his article at our website, radioboston.org. And Yoni Applebaum is senior editor at the Atlantic, where he oversees the politics section. Thank you so very much for joining us today. It's very, very appreciated.
Always a pleasure.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
All right, to the Hall of Mammals.
To the Hall of Mammals.
To the Hall of Mammals.
Biff, bam, pow, science! Well, like a pair of nerdy wannabe superheroes that we are, Professor Jonathan Losos and I dash into Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology.
We just walk right over here, down the hallway,
Okay, so we actually walked, as you just heard. But Losos is the curator of herpetology here, and he studies lizards and evolution. And he's put a lot of his thinking into the new book, Improbable Destinies, Fate, Chance, and the Future of Evolution. It's an exploration of the strange and wonderful paths that evolution has taken across the planet. Wait, paths, you say? Don't you mean just one path? Because, you know, Darwin figured out survival of the fittest, species are naturally selected, yada, yada, yada. But Professor Losos says there's a whole lot in that yada, yada, yada. In fact, there are still fundamental questions about the way life evolves, such as, are the species we see today inevitabilities? Or are they just evolutionary flukes? And how about this one? If life got another chance to evolve in a similar environment, would the exact same things happen or not?
I think it all started with a scientist here at Harvard, very famous, named Stephen Jay Gould. And he coined this phrase that if you could replay the tape of life, somehow go back and start over, would you get the same outcome? And he argued, no, you would get a very different outcome. Just random, fluky events would send evolution down another path. And the outcome, as a result, would be very different. And so his argument, which was extremely influential, was that there's a role for what he called contingency, just the particular events that happen that shape the course of evolution. And so he at one point said, you know, you could replay the tape a million times and you would never get anything like humans again. But there were actually no data. This was in the 1980s. No one was studying this question. So it was all rhetoric and logic and philosophy, really. But he was so inspirational that people went out and started trying to ask the question of how predictable or repeatable is evolution. And now, 30 years later, we actually do have a lot of data. And those data give us a more nuanced view.
But what are the data, though, right? Because we only have our one evolutionary
That's
path.
Exactly. We don't, yeah. The history, there's only one history.
Yeah.
But the data are two things. One is, as we have gotten a better and better understanding of the evolutionary tree of life, how species are related to each other, we are discovering many instances in which species that we thought were closely related, because they are very similar, actually aren't. The debate used to be which one is more common, and we now know both are common. And the real question is trying to understand why you get convergence in some cases and not others.
Can we see some examples of the convergence?
Yes.
Ones?
Well, let's turn around. Okay. And here we're looking at an animal called the thylacine, sometimes called the Tasmanian wolf or the Tasmanian tiger. And I think most people, if they saw that and didn't know anything better, would think it's an interesting breed of dog. But it's not. It's a marsupial. It's related to kangaroos, but it adapted to have a very similar lifestyle to wolves, and it has a very similar appearance. And then if we go to the next case over, we have what's called a sugar glider. It's, again, another marsupial, but it looks just like a flying squirrel.
Yeah.
It's got the big flaps of skin, and it can glide from one tree to another. And it's, again, done the exact same thing as the flying squirrel, but it is a marsupial. So marsupials, many of them have evolved convergently with their parallel forms in the rest of the world that are not marsupials.
We still have the duckbill platypus type one offs, though,
well,
right?
Well, that's, you know, that's what it comes down to, is the debate has come down to the convergent evolution crowd having this long, enormous list of examples of convergent evolution, but the other side could make just as long a list of things that haven't converged.
So on that, let me ask you, I mean, this is just wandering into the realm of pure hypothesis, but, you know, given the fact that when DNA sorts itself, you can have an infinite number of combinations, right, in the random assortment of genes. So is what we know about genetics these days, does that help us understand that perhaps there is something to the notion that you, of what Stephen Jay Gould was talking about, that you could have all sorts of different outcomes because there are an infinite number of ways that genes can mix themselves.
Yes, and as we're now able to sequence genomes, people are actually drilling down and finding the actual genetic basis of convergence. And one of the very interesting findings is that in some cases, even distantly related species will have the exact same mutation leading to the same adaptive response. So sometimes the convergence goes down to the genetic level, but in many cases it doesn't. In many cases they evolve the same feature, the same phenotype, as we call it, the same external feature, but when you look at the genes, they've done it through different genetic changes.
That is fascinating.
Yeah, it's fabulous.
That is super fascinating. I always have to take it out to outer space. What does this mean for, if there were an Earth-like planet out there?
Well, this is...
Would we end up with humanoids?
Well, Hollywood thinks so. And there are some people, based on this idea of convergent evolution, on the idea that the environment poses particular challenges and that natural selection finds the same answers, that argue that life on other planets will look very similar to life here, so much so that some people claim that humanoid-type individuals with species with higher intelligence will occur on those planets. I'm dubious. As I just told you, the extent to which convergence occurs, the more distantly related species are, the less likely they are to evolve in the same way, to adapt in the same way. And, of course, you couldn't be more distantly related than an independent life form on another planet. It's much more likely that completely different ways of adapting would evolve.
Right. And we also can't tell sort of what the dominant pressures in the environment were. There's got to be a whole mix of them at any particular time.
Exactly. And in fact, one of the things that biologists are very clear about these days is that a lot of the natural selection pressures come from other species.
Yeah. I mean, well, changing it because of the pressure of different species, it makes me think of the pressures that humankind is putting on the planet and what effect that has on how life is evolving.
That's absolutely true. And that's, you know, the other thing I talk about in my book is that one of the things that Darwin got wrong, and someone just told me, no, you can't say Darwin got something wrong, but the fact is, he thought that evolution occurs extremely slowly. Well, we now know that's wrong. We know that when natural selection pressures are strong, populations can adapt extremely quickly, quickly enough to see over a couple of years' time. And so that means that what we're doing to this planet now, changing the world in so many ways, well, it's an inadvertent evolution experiment. We are subjecting species to new conditions, and we will see if they can adapt to them, and if so, how.
It's very sobering.
Well, it's, you know,
I mean, it's happening, but it's also very sobering.
It is sobering, but also exciting in a way. Evolution turns out to be very relevant to the here and now, that understanding how it occurs will tell us how and whether species can adapt.
This is so great. We could spend the whole day in here. Yeah, but no I feel doubt. Like we should talk about lizards.
All right. So we're going to go back this way. So now we're going to descend into the bowels of the Museum of Comparative Zoology. Okay, so this room is full of specimens of lizards. It's one of the greatest collections of lizard specimens in the world.
I mean, are we looking at thousands and thousands of specimen jars here?
Yes, we are. This is just like a library with one of these rolling shelves, so it's very economical in squeezing them all in. But as you'll see, there are just jar after jar documenting the diversity of lizards of the world.
So how did you fall in love with lizards?
Well, I mean, like many children, it started with dinosaurs. I was fascinated with dinosaurs as a little boy. And, you know, this was back in the 1960s where, you know, I read books, I had the plastic animals, I loved dinosaurs. And then as I got older, of course, dinosaurs aren't around, except for birds, we now know, but that didn't really count. So I became fascinated with living reptiles. And a particularly important event in my life when I was about 10 or 11 was convincing my mother to let me get a baby caiman, which is a South American relative of the alligator. And I got them as pets, and they were nasty little animals, but fascinating.
So what did your lobbying effort include to convince your mother?
Well, so I had gotten the idea from an episode of Leave It to Beaver, which I don't know if kids these days know Leave It to Beaver, but a classic television show where the beaver had bought a baby, had ordered a baby alligator from Captain Jack's alligator farm and smuggled it into his house, and his mother didn't know about it, and hilarity ensues. So I got the idea. I knew that pet stores sold caimans, and I asked my mother, and my mother is not the sort of woman who likes to say no. So instead she said, we'll ask Mr. Hessel, the at that time deputy director of the St. Louis Zoo, what he thinks. And my mom was counting on Mr. Hessel putting the kibosh on the idea. And so I bugged my father. He was a family friend, I should say. I bugged my father for several weeks. And finally, one day, my dad comes home and he says, well, I spoke with Mr. Hessel and he said it's a great idea. That's how he got his start in zoology. And so my mom was stuck. And so we went and got a caiman. And then she went back and bought a second one because she felt bad that it was lonely, which was, you know, I doubt that caimans get lonely. But anyway, so I had two caimans and they were They're nasty little animals. Alligators, it turns out, are quite docile and make reasonable pets. But caimans have a nastier disposition. So you had to be careful when we handled them.
Wow. I mean, I feel like we've talked to so many scientists now that this is a unifying thing, that in their background there was always someone who either couldn't say no or said, try it. That's a great idea.
Absolutely.
And they were headed down the road to more science.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, I guess a part of me wants to know what you think is the craziest lizard species you've got here.
That is a fighting word. Which one? The craziest lizard species. Well, we do have some big guys, but should we look in the tank?
Yes,
do you want to see?
All right. I'd love to.
Okay, we're taking off the lid.
Whoa!
And here we go. A bunch of Nile monitors. They're found throughout the continent. This is a species that has a very long whip-like tail. They can get 5 feet, maybe 6 feet long.
These ones look balled up. Yeah.
They're all balled up. So let's take a look at one of them. So it's a pretty, if we stretch this guy out, I bet he would be 5 feet long. These are fabulous lizards. These are certainly among the best ones.
What is it that lizards, I mean, this is a very broad question, but what is it that lizards have to teach us?
Well, number one, they're great survivors. They were around at the time of the dinosaurs, and increasingly we're finding very cool fossils of lizards going way back in time. And they're incredibly diverse. Right now, there are about 10,000 species of lizards in the world today, occupying almost any habitat you can imagine on land. They don't get to the far north and far south because it's too cold, but otherwise they're all over the place. And in some areas, you'll find more lizards than you find mammals or birds.
Okay, so the last question I have. Do we know why T-Rex had such short arms?
Do we? That is a great question. The T-Rex had these...
My 7-year-old is dying to know.
These ridiculously little arms for its body size. And, I mean, this highlights both the excitement of evolutionary biology and the frustration. Because, of course, T-Rex has been gone for 66 million years. There's nothing like it today. How do we figure out what its arms are for? And there are lots of ideas, and some of these ideas are kind of crazy. One idea is that it evolved particularly short arms to make sure it didn't bite them off in a feeding frenzy. That seems kind of ridiculous.
Yes.
Other people have argued that they did little T-Rex push-ups, and they were taking a nap, and they needed to roll over and push off the ground. Their little arms would push them off the ground. Now, I'm not sure why little arms would be useful there, but some scientists propose that. Or maybe that the male used the two claws, they only had two fingers, to titillate the female in courtship. These ideas are all in the scientific literature. If only we could do an experiment, get a bunch of theropod dinosaurs, put them on little continents, and come back a million years later and see what happens.
Maybe. There was a movie like that. It didn't turn out well.
Yeah, maybe someday.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has been absolutely a joy and fascinating, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, my pleasure.
Jonathan Losos is curator of herpetology at Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology. His new book is Improbable: Destinies, Fate, Chance, and the Future of Evolution.